This podcast is brought to you by BetRivers. Download the BetRivers app from the App Store or Google Play Store. Must be 21. Available in Ohio only. Void where prohibited. Terms and conditions apply. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Sports gaming is provided in partnership with Dayton Real Estate Ventures, LLC, DBA, Hollywood Gaming at Dayton Raceway.
If you're a tennis fan, you'll love Betting Weekly Game Bet Match on the BetRivers Network. Whether you're a bettor or just love tennis, you'll enjoy the in-depth analysis each week of the tennis calendar. Subscribe to Game Bet Match today from your favorite podcast provider. It's the Mike Francesa Podcast on the BetRivers Network.
Hello again, everybody, and welcome to the Mike Francesa Podcast on this Friday morning. And remember, the Mike Francesa Podcast on the BetRivers Network is brought to you by Casamigos Tequila. Casamigos Tequila, brought to you by those who drink it. This Friday morning, we wake up and we almost have a completed Masters first round. 23 golfers will do that this morning, have to finish up. Included in that number is Tiger Woods, who has five holes to play. He is currently one of the 31 golfers who is under par. He is minus one. There is a host at minus one, a bevy at minus two, and then a couple above that. And then you get to the top where you have DeChambeau, who had a great round yesterday. And he had not played well at the Masters before that, despite a lot of anticipation with his length, at minus seven. And then the one and only Scottie Scheffler, the overwhelming favorite to win this tournament. At six under, and that's, let's put DeChambeau aside for a second and say that he comes back to earth today. Maybe he does, maybe he doesn't. He has a world of talent. We know that. But what you have to fear now, if you are in this Masters field, is that Scheffler backs up, and his tee time this afternoon is 1:48, I believe. You have to worry that Scheffler goes out and puts another of these rounds together and is 12 or 13 under par after two rounds. Because if you're someone who finds himself even a stroke or two under par, playing okay golf, even putting together a couple of decent rounds, you're not catching him. That's all there is to it. I mean, so really, he has a chance, the way he is playing golf and the way he has played golf this year, to distance himself from everybody this side of just a handful of golfers. Now, he had a couple of guys who played well yesterday, okay, including a couple of surprises. You got some familiar names like Homer at minus four and Hatton at minus three and, you know, give me an example. Neiman is minus two. Zalatoris, who one of my picks is minus two. Those are fine rounds. But when Scheffler comes out and shoots six under, you have to worry about him doing that. Now, remember this. If you're one of the people who said, hey, regardless of price, and his price was almost Tiger Woods-like, he was 4-1. The next favorite was 11-1. That was McIlroy at 11-1 and Rahm at 12-1. Next after that was 18-1. He was 4-1 to win the tournament. Not a great price. As a matter of fact, a very poor price. If you were someone who said, I'm jumping on Scotty, he's been that dominant this year, and I'm taking the 4-1, understand there is another little fly in the ointment. And I'm sure by now you know this, but if you just happen that you didn't catch this information, Scheffler's wife is somewhere between 2 and 3 weeks from being due with their first child. Scheffler, as you would expect, is on pins and needles. He has made it abundantly clear that should his wife experience anything, including any kind of situation, or go into labor, he is out of there at the next moment. that he doesn't care if he's leading the tournament. He doesn't care if he's got a 5-stroke lead. He is not staying. Even if it's Sunday, he's not staying. So understand, he has made it abundantly clear that if he gets any news of any kind, he is gone, no matter where his positioning is. He has stated that, and he hasn't even vacillated a little about it. He is gone. The plane will be ready, and he is on his way. So just take that into account. Now, if you already wagered on him, there's nothing you can do about it. It's unlikely anything will occur this weekend. If he had it weighing on his mind, he sure didn't show it yesterday as he went out and played brilliant golf again. And that was after he knew that DeChambeau had posted a big round. He went out there and just played his round, you know, knocked it in out of the sand, hit all but 2 fairways, you know, was in very little trouble, and went around the place in brilliant fashion. So he is exactly where you would thought he would be, if not in a better position than you thought he would be. Tiger Woods is 1 under par. He has struck the ball fine. 1 under par through 13. He still has to play 15. Obviously, he has to play the difficult holes of 17 and 18. He knows the course and plays it as well as anybody. And that's not the issue. The issue is, as he plays day after day, can he get around the course? I sensed a limp already yesterday. Now, he always has a little bit of a limp in his gait now anyway, but I sensed him starting to favor his leg a little bit later in the round. And today, he's got to play 5 holes, take a break, and go back out and play 18 holes. Sounds realistic. Sounds fine. Hey, how many days has he done more than that? 1 million. But he is a very, very different case when it comes to his body. He is very fragile now. His back and his knee are not good. He has to go through a lot to even get to the course. He goes through an amazing amount of physical therapy and stretching just to get to play. Now, we all know how brilliant he is. No one disputes that for a second. But I just don't think he can get around the place for 4 straight days. Today will be a telling day. Check him out, not after 5 holes today. Check him out on the back side of his round this afternoon. That's when you'll see how he's really doing and whether he can hold up. But right now, he is 1 under par. Mickelson, who was 100-1, Tiger was 150-1 to win the tournament, and I didn't think either one were winning the tournament anyway, but Mickelson was playing very, very, very good golf until he put the ball in the water. And at 16, for him, a mistake he doesn't usually make. He bogeyed 16, he bogeyed 17, and finished 1 over par. Otherwise, he came in under par on his round. And again, remember, no matter how Phil's playing, he seems to always play better at the Masters. He just loves the course. He fits the course. He loves the course. He knows probably more about it than anybody this side of Tiger or Jack Nicklaus. And +1 was a round that put you right in the middle yesterday. But he easily could have had better, and he was very unhappy because he bogeyed 16 and 17. But he's +1, which is not bad. If you're thinking about the other favorites, Koepka, even par through 11 holes. Rahm finished a disappointing 1 over for his round. So if Rahm is going to make a move on Scheffler, he needs to make it today. He can't lose another 5 or 6 strokes to Scheffler today and be in good shape. That will be over. He has got to at least not lose any more ground. Right now, he's 7 behind Scheffler as it is. He can't lose any more ground to him if he's thinking about winning this tournament. So if you're interested in those two, who are always considered very, very dangerous players, Koepka, even par, has holes to play today. And Rahm finishes round, but at 1 over par, which is disappointing for him. Like we said, there's 31 golfers under par. But when you have a Scheffler and plenty of good golfers at -2, I mean, plenty of name golfers at -2 or -1. I picked Zalatoris, he's -2. I picked Hovland, he's -1. He was -4. And then he double bogeyed and wound up losing one more stroke, and he finished -1 for the day. Disappointing considering he was on the board at -4 earlier. Wyndham Clark got up and was on the board and then put the ball in the water and wound up, I believe, right around even par. A lot of people liked him this week. I think he finished the day at even par, which was disappointing. +1, as a matter of fact, even more disappointing, considering he was on the board mid-round at -3 and looked like he was on his way. So, again, today, today we kind of take shape. We get rid of the people who had bad rounds. And getting to that, if you yesterday are thinking of winning this tournament and put up a +3 or +4, if you don't shoot a real low number today, you're in big trouble the way Scheffler got off. And let's not take anything away from DeChambeau, who's sitting there at -7. I would put those at the +2s or better of the big names. The guys there are Spieth, double bogeyed the first hole. He's +2. Burns is +3. Matsuyama. A lot of people picked Matsuyama. Matsuyama finished +4. He's going to have trouble making the cut. He's right now 75th out of 80-something golfers. So he is at +4 in one of the worst rounds of the day. And from a standpoint of that, Fred Couples shot a +8, and Malnati, who was a rookie player, shot +10. He was the worst at 89th golfer. But of the guys who were considered favorites, Matsuyama was a guy a lot of people liked because he was playing great this year, and he's always played well at the Masters. +4, he's got a lot of work to do just to make the cut. Spieth at +2, as an example. And of the guys who are going to win this turn, Dustin Johnson +1, bunch of +1, plus a bunch at -1, couple at -2, and they're all chasing Scheffler and DeChambeau, who are -6 and -7. So it looks like we are going to get excellent weather the rest of the weekend. It could be windy today, but it's going to be nice. And then they said Saturday and Sunday are going to be perfect Masters Day. So we should get no more delays. Everybody will be up to the finish after today. Well, on Saturday, moving day, everybody will have played their 2 rounds. There won't be any issues there. And then we're going to have very good weather the rest of the weekend for the Masters. Now, during each round of the Masters, BetRivers is offering betting specials. Visit the BetRivers app for full details and discover what awaits each day of the tournament as they give you some enticing betting specials they come up with throughout the day, and they will shoot you those during the round. So go to the BetRivers app and you will see those all through the Masters as we all watch today. It'll be on ESPN this morning at 8 o'clock, some extra coverage, and then 3 o'clock this afternoon. You know, you can go to the Masters app and watch all day, and you have tomorrow and Sunday on CBS as always. as the Masters will, I'm sure, put forth another show. And the best golfer in the world did not disappoint. That is really the headline of day number one, is that world number one, heavy favorite, a player that if you, you know, we play this crazy pool and there's a lot of entrants. There might be 1,000 entrants into the pool. It's a wonderful, very computerized pool with all kinds of things. And you have to take guys from different columns. So column A is the top 20 players in the world, and you get to pick four. So right there, you got to make some really, you can't play all of them. I mean, you're going to have all the big names right there, and you can only pick four of them. But if you look down the list, and they, you know, they put out a printout beforehand, and you look down the Scheffler column, I would say 96% of the people put Scheffler on every single card. That's how dominant he is right now. He's almost as dominant as we've seen in a long time, since the days where it was, would you take Tiger against the field, which is as dominant as golf gets. And there were some years where people would take Tiger against the rest of the field. It hasn't reached the point where you would take Scheffler against the rest of the field. But when you look at how he has dominated, yes, a PGA that does not have a lot of stars who are over on LIV, we know that, he still is playing dominant golf. And when he faced the full field at the Masters, he faced every one of the top 50 players in the world. You know, there was the issue of world points and everything and getting everybody in. The only one who was a problem was Joaquin Niemann. They got him in on a special exemption. They had the top 50 players in the world. It's always a very select field. It's always much shorter than the other fields. They don't let a lot of people in. It's an invitation or based on performance. The top 50, though, was supposed to be there, and they all are. So you're facing a great field with the top 50 players in the world all accounted for. He is came out, and other than DeChambeau, who shot 7 under, he shot 6 under and put himself in position to win another Masters and to continue to dominate the world of golf as he has this year almost completely. I mean, his play this year has been extraordinary. He was a putt away from winning a third straight tournament. I mean, that's dominant golf when you win 3 straight tournaments. Tournaments are hard to win, as you know. And when you win Arnie and then turn around and win the Players and have that kind of performance, I mean, that's special golf. And he is playing that, and it looks like he would like to stamp the Masters on his way to maybe making a big run at a tremendous year this season. Now, he's going to have this child here. How that impacts his schedule, you know, leading up to the U.S. Open and everything else, we'll have to wait and see. But, you know, PGA, U.S. Open, everything that's going on in the next couple of months, it'll be interesting to see. Very interesting to see, as a matter of fact. So, Scheffler is the story of day one. Tiger, as always, the Tiger watch is on. Everyone is always hoping that he can somehow find his way to the leaderboard on Saturday and Sunday. So far, 1 under par. It's looked okay. And he's got 5 holes to finish this morning and then play his 18 this afternoon. You know, we are getting closer to the NBA playoffs, which are right around the corner. The Stanley Cups playoffs right around the corner. And there's a lot of anticipation here in New York, and there should be, especially with the play of the Knicks and the Rangers. But the draft is also closing in quickly, and the intrigue and the buzz that is surrounding the top of this draft is it just intensifies by the day. I mean, we all talk to people before the draft. You know, we all get into the draft. We all like all these different rumors about the top of the draft. You know, that intrigue dies after the first 10 picks, but it's interesting. And this year, it's fascinating because you have these 4 quarterbacks and you're including the Michigan quarterback now in that group, because clearly rumors have illustrated that he is in that group. And although I've heard even rumblings that he would go too. Now, remember, Washington's not trading a pick. They're taking a quarterback. I do not think they will take him. But there have even been people trying to tell you that they will take him. Now, has he risen that high on the board to where he would upset it? Also, you have the presence of Marvin Harrison Jr. And while some people have tried to dismiss that, do not. It would not surprise me at all if he goes in between. I think quarterbacks are going off the board 1-2. I even would say quarterbacks are going off the board 1-2-3, because I think that either a quarterback will be taken in the Patriots position or they will trade the pick to someone who wants to take a quarterback. But after that, I think Harrison's off the board by 4. I think he has a very good chance of breaking the 4 quarterbacks. Now, I think in the first 5 picks, you are going to have the 4 quarterbacks and Harrison. I think that will be the top 5 picks. And then it adds intrigue going forward, because there are teams now that you hear that are trying to get up into the top 12 to maybe take Knicks. Is that true? Is that not true? You know, how many more quarterbacks could go off the board in the first round? Are we there? Are we headed for the second round? Or after 5? Are we going to get more than 5? So this draft has 3 veins of talent that are going to be hit 1-2-3. The first vein of talent is the quarterbacks. The second vein of talent, led by Harrison, will be the wide receivers, of which there are 3, counting Harrison, who are going in the top 10 picks, probably the top 9 picks, but definitely the top 10 picks. So you have Harrison, Neighbors, and Odunze from Washington, who is going to be a terrific player. Then you have the presence of the tackles, of which there are a handful of tackles who, remember, big-time offensive tackles go very high in the draft. And I think Alter's the best of the group. He's also the most established of the group. And I have said to you, if he ever slipped to 10, which I think could happen if he doesn't go to Tennessee, if Tennessee takes him, we can't do anything about it. But if not, I think the Jets are going to be posed with a very interesting question, and one that it'll be interesting to see how they answer. Do they take Bowers, the tight end from Georgia, who no one can dispute is going to be? Kincaid came in the league and played really well. Bowers is better than Kincaid. Bowers is going to be a prototypical all-star tight end. I have no doubt about it. But Alt is going to be a all-pro tackle. And the kind of guy who you basically can plug in and leave alone for a decade. And when you can do that, you know what? It really causes you to have a lot fewer headaches when you can have someone anchor your offensive line on that level. So his presence is going to be fascinating. Now the Giants at 6, are the 4 quarterbacks gone? I think they are. So I don't think the Giants, you have to think about the Giants taking a quarterback at 6. I think they're taking a wide receiver. I've thought so all along. Which one they take will be fascinating. Everyone thinks they're in love with the speed of Neighbors. We'll see. He might not be a Giant kid in terms of temperament. You're not hearing. Now, again, I don't like to get involved in that stuff because I haven't checked on this kid, so I don't know what's real and what's not real. But, you know, there are some people throwing red flags in this kid's personality, and he might be hard to handle and all these different things. Who knows? You know, they say that about Tyreek Hill. He's a, you know, he can be a pain in the rear end, but he's also a dominant force in the league. If you could have a Tyreek Hill, you're taking him. You'll deal with the couple of problems that arise. You're taking him. If he can break a game open like that and be that dominating. Now, I'm not saying anybody's going to be Tyreek Hill because he's exceptional. He is one-in-a-generation type wide receiver because he's not only incredibly fast, he's also quick in a small area, and he's tough. He is tough. So that's a rare, rare kid. That's a rare wide receiver. These guys might be as fast, they might be, and that's saying a lot, might be somewhat near as talented, and that's saying a lot. Are they going to be as tough as he is? Hard to say. Really hard to say. But it's fascinating here because I think there's going to be more options and decision-making for the Jets at 10 than there is for the Giants at 6, because I think the Giants are going to hit right on the wide receiver vein, and they're just going to be, all right, we're looking at wide receivers here. They're jumping off the page. We're taking one. Because the quarterbacks will be gone. I think Minnesota has somehow traded into the 3 or 4 spot because they're desperate to do that. So I figure Minnesota's on the phone working in the past until they say yes, or working Arizona till they say yes. And I think if Harrison is on the board at 5, there's no way. There's no way the Chargers are passing him up. Just no way. I can't see them doing that. So I don't think he goes past 5, even if the quarterbacks go off the board 1, 2, 3, 4. Who trades in? Does somebody else? New Orleans doesn't have. New Orleans, there's a lot of talk about them trading in, but they don't have the wherewithal to trade into that top part of that draft. I mean, not New Orleans, Denver. Denver. Sean is looking to trade into the draft for a quarterback, but he can't get high enough. I don't think he can get, I think he could get high enough to get him in the 12 range or somewhere in there and take one of the secondary, like if you consider Nick's a secondary quarterback. There's a lot of talk about him being taken somewhere. Teams trading up to get him once the board's passed those dominant players, where you got the 4 quarterbacks off the board, you have the 3 wide receivers off the board, you have the tackles off the board, and you have Bowers off the board. When that's all cleaned out, and that's cleaned out by like 11, then does somebody move to get Nick's? You there are going to have some tackles taken, a couple of edge pass rushes in that area, a couple more tackles, and that's where you could see your quarterback slipping. After you've gotten those dominant, you get the 4 quarterbacks, the 3 wide receivers, the couple of tackles, and Bowers. There's talk that Atlanta might take a defensive player there. I think Atlanta, if Dunze's on the board, I would take him. And I'd worry about getting a pass rusher later because I don't think there's a player that I've seen on defense as good as he is on offense if he's there for Atlanta. So that'll be interesting too. And Tennessee will impact the Jet draft because if they don't take Alt, then what do the Jets do with 10? Take Alt to Bowers. And that is a very decision that'll weigh on that franchise for a while. It really will. You know, I'm looking at the Ohtani story as it unfolds, and I don't know how accurate the reporting is because it differs in a couple of places. Obviously, you got to understand that Major League Baseball is circling the wagons to protect their player here. There's no question. But explain to me a couple of things that are being reported here. Number one, how could a guy who is an interpreter, who is on a limited salary, be allowed to wager? No bookmaker would ever allow a guy who did not have serious resources wager the type of figures that are being discussed with the wagering. The wagering being discussed is phenomenally high. The size of the bets, there's no way anybody would take those bets in their right mind if they didn't know that was being backed up by real money, by money they could count on and touch. Now, could the translator have gone to the bookmaker and said, hey, listen, I got the Otani money behind me? And could he have proved that by paying off one large wager? If that happened, the guy might let him bet again. But I can't see him letting him run up a debt on the kind of wages they are saying were bet. I mean, you're talking about incredible amounts of money. Then you're getting reports that the translator was now some kind of mastermind who not only kept Otani in the dark, but was able to change the numbers. I actually read this, change the numbers on the accounts. How is that possible unless he had inside help from inside the banks? And now you're talking about a huge crime with embezzlement and everything else where they had inside help. Because how are you telling me he was able to change the numbers on the accounts so that the money that was being taken out of the account didn't show up for Otani? Now, listen, Otani, I am sure, did not leave, you know, $20 or $30 million in a checking account. Because if he did, his financial advisors should be shot. Why would you do that? Nobody does that. You put the money in accounts that you are able to touch if you want and transfer if you want and are liquid if you want, but you're still putting them in accounts that are making good amounts of money when you're talking about that kind of money. It doesn't make any sense of money management. You're telling me Otani didn't have any financial advisors? And then his financial advisors did not know this was going on. And Otani now did not know this was going on because the guy changed the numbers on the accounts? How did he do that? Again, if you've ever dealt with a bank, and I'm sure you all have, or you've ever sent a wire transfer, you know what has to be done to send one. There are conversations that go on. There are talking to more than one person. There are passcodes that go back and forth. There's all kinds of safeguards that are put in place. You're telling me this guy was able to do this all this time, and he actually changed the numbers on the accounts? How is that humanly possible? But the one thing you're not seeing is any reporting that even gets Otani anywhere near this, despite the fact the numbers are growing substantially. The numbers are getting larger, but you're hearing Otani knew nothing about it. It just doesn't all add up. I am not accusing Otani of doing anything. I don't know anything about what went on. And I'm not accusing Otani of being, I'm not saying he waged it. I'm not saying anything. What I'm saying is the story that is being presented doesn't make any sense. It does not sound like the actions of a bookmaker. And then reporting that the translator was able to change the numbers on Otani's accounts. I can't even fathom how that would be humanly possible to do. And you would have to have inside help to do it. if it could even possibly be done. And I'm sure Otani has people who were handling his money. Were they involved? Was there a money guy involved in this? Was there a middleman involved in this? Was there a guy Otani allowed to manage his money that was involved in this? Or you're telling me he gave complete carte blanche to his interpreter? So he gave his interpreter complete access to all his money? Doesn't make any sense. So as they present this story, it doesn't add up. I'm not saying what the story is because I don't know what the story is. And I am not indicting Otani in any way, but baseball will go and bend over backwards to try to protect this player. That I have no doubt. And remember, the first story that came out had Otani involved. The second story, Otani was out. Knew nothing about anything. After the first story that he was involved and he knew about the money. Which makes a lot more sense in the handling of finances from a standpoint of the wages being okayed by Otani, because otherwise how could a bookmaker know he's going to get paid when a guy's making $80,000? First thing they want to know when you talk with someone who you're going to make big bets with is, what are your resources? Wait a second. What do you do for a living? How much you make? You don't think they ask that? They do ask that. They know how you present yourself. They see how you dress. They see what kind of car you drive. They know what your job is. They know who you are. You're a translator. You think he's making as a translator $9 or $10 million a year? And then the story comes out that he was able to change the numbers on the account. What? How would you do that? I've never even heard of anybody doing that. So there's still more to this story than we know. I don't know which turn it's going to take or where it's going. And I am not accusing, because I don't have the wherewithal to accuse anybody of anything. I don't know anything about this case. But what's being presented as fact is very hard to digest. It really is. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. There's something wrong with the whole picture when you're talking about a guy who makes $82,000 a year and he's dealing in these circles where they're wagering millions of dollars. Something's fishy. Very, very fishy. Now, as we open up a weekend series and the Yankees hit the road and the Mets come home, the Yankees obviously playing very, very good baseball. Off to one of their faster starts in a long time. You've already seen the shift that everybody has hoped for. And listen, I don't think it was premature. I didn't mind if they waited a little longer till they did it. The Yankees have been hurting for a leadoff hitter for a while. Now, if Volpe is going to play like this, if he is going to use the whole field, cut down on his strikeouts, take walks, and be a far more discerning hitter than with his speed and power and youth and everything else, he's a perfect leadoff hitter. Volpe 1, Soto 2, Judge 3 is terrific. Now, Volpe's hitting. He's off to a fast start. He's hitting 370. He's got an OPS over 1, so does Soto. He's hitting. He take walks. Soto has a philosophy that you have to understand will not be broken. You will see him in big spots, home run spots, drive in the run spots, win the game spots. He will still not swing at a pitch outside his zone. Some guys, you know, Ted Williams was that way, and he got criticized for it often. He would not go outside his zone when they were going to throw a ball off the plate. He was taking it and putting it to the next hitter. Now, sometimes you don't want him to do that, but remember, with the Yankees, the next hitter is Judge. Now, you had that classic example the other night when Judge flied out. When he got jammed and he flied out to the out and to center field, to end the game with the bases loaded after Soto would walk. Soto will not expand his zone. He is an extremely, extremely disciplined hitter. The things you notice about Soto at the plate when you watch him every day are these. Number one, his balance and his leg drive at the plate is superb. Number two, he has an incredibly discerning eye. He doesn't walk a lot out of fear. It's not the kind of walks. He gets a lot of walks, but he's not getting as many walks as he gets because he's feared like Bonds was or feared like Mantle was. He's getting those walks because he will not expand his zone at all. And number three, he does not give an inch on left-handed pitching. As a matter of fact, he hits left-handed pitching as well as you will see a left-handed hitter hit left-handed pitching. He never bails. His shoulder never wavers. He is always in the proper hitting stance and ready to attack even any pitch from a left-hander. Makes no difference to him. And that's very, very rare for a left-handed hitter to not have any weakness against left-handed pitching. And he does not. Now, I've already heard people rumbling that maybe Judge's slow start, and he's off to a very slow start, is the product of him trying to settle in with having another superstar in the lineup. It's been Judge and Judge alone when, you know, if Judge didn't hit, the Yankees didn't win. Judge was the guy. He was the only guy who was on that level with this team. I mean, Stanton was a slugger. Rizzo is a good player. They were not anywhere near Judge's league. Now Judge has a guy in the lineup who is on his level. Has Judge been somehow hampered in trying to perform around Soto? I don't buy it. I know people feel that way, that maybe that it's been an adjustment for him. I don't buy it. If anything, I think it will help him. Now, remember, Soto's in front of Judge, which is going to help Soto get a lot better pitches to hit. You know, you go back to 61. Mantle got off to a torrid start. Maris, the year before, had come to the Yankees. He had beaten Mantle by a vote in the MVP. Mantle hit 40 homers. Roger, though, had a better season. He did have a better season. And Roger finished first in the MVP voting. At the start of the season, Mantle was batting third and Roger was batting fourth. Roger got off to a slow start. They called him in and said, we're going to flip-flop. And Maris took off. Why? Because now he's seeing much better pitching because he's in front of Mantle. Maris, in a year where he hit 61 home runs, did not get one intentional pass. Think about that. Think about the presence of Mickey Mantle behind you and what it means when you hit 61 homers and you never get an intentional pass in the entire season. Which is hard to fathom. Really is. I don't remember how many walks Roger Maris had that. You'd have to look it up. But batting in front of Mantle, who wound up hitting 54 home runs and hit 317, and I think he knocked in 132 runs, 128 runs. 132 sticks in my mind, but it might have been 128. Just shows you what can happen in the lineup that way. Now, I don't think the Yankees, I wonder if it's been debated a little bit. Hey, how about if we flip Judge and Soto for a couple of days just to get Judge started and see if Judge sees some better pitching because Soto bats behind him? But I don't think they'll do that because now you got righty batting first. You want Soto batting second. Soto's on base is always going to be higher than Judge's. Put Judge third. Judge should hit more homers than Soto, so put him third and go from there. They'll be fine. It's just that, hey, the weather's been very cold. It has not been conducive to hitting. You got guys that are off the slow start. Some guys are usually off the slow. Now, Judge has not one of them, but Judge has not, you know, he's had his moments. He's hit the ball okay. He had the home run, the double in the game in Arizona. He just hasn't gotten going yet. He's got a 178 batting average, a 745 OPS. Those are not Judge numbers, clearly. Do I believe he's somehow being, you know, standoffish or just trying to learn to live with the specter of Soto? I don't buy it. I don't think it's I'll look for that. I don't think it's a crazy thing to bring up, but I don't think it's true. What the Yankee lineup has now that it hasn't had in the last couple of years is balance, lefty, righty, and depth. The lineup used to have great depth and length to it. Now it does again, where the bottom of the lineup doesn't just kill you. It's not great, but doesn't kill you. Now, when Stanton hits, this lineup looks really different because when he's on, he mashes the ball. And he can drive anything out of the ballpark. The guy who bears some watching is Rizzo. Rizzo suffered a weird injury last year. He's not young. He's 34 years old, which is still, you could have plenty of good years at that age. He had that concussion or whatever the heck he had from that collision last year. He's got a homer and four RBIs, hitting 245. His OPS is in the sixes, not good. He hasn't hit the ball very hard. But what concerns me more is how bad his defense has been. You know, Rizzo's always been a terrific fielder. His fielding has really been shaky. And that was a given with him, that he's going to make every play and make every scoop and be that kind of player around the bag. He has looked shaky on defense, which would be a little bit of an alarm for me to watch whether or not he can be that everyday player. Now, you know how close he is to Judge. He and Judge are inseparable. And he's your first baseman. But there's nothing wrong with figuring out who gets the extra days at first base. They can start to think about a guy playing some first base against certain lefties, you know, day game after night game, and giving him a little more rest. I don't think Stanton can play first base at all. I don't think he can. First base is not an easy position. First of all, if people think you just throw a guy at first base, that's wrong. First base is a busy position. You're involved in a lot of things and a lot of cutoffs and a lot of different things. And you also can make plays that really help Aaron throws from your infielders if you're able to do that. I mean, a guy who's good at that, a Keith Hernandez and Mattingly, they save an incredible number of errors with what they can do. But whether it's LeMahieu, whoever it is, I know Torres is off to a slow start. I would not worry about Torres at all. Torres is going to hit. Torres is almost like, I always think of Torres as like he's separate with the Yankees, like he's off by himself, but you never have to worry about him. He's not going to be great, but he's going to be plenty good, and he's good late in the game. I don't mind him. I don't worry about him. I don't mind him. Judge, I don't think it's anything to worry about. Rizzo, Stanton, I think it's the same we've been dealing with all along. It's feast, it's famine, it's feast, it's famine. You're going to go through both. You're going to go through the feast days. You're going to go through the famine days. Rizzo bears watching. But not just offensively, defensively. He bears watching. I say it's amazing how positive, when I've turned on the radio in the car, or I've heard people calling in at different times, or, you know, if I happen to be driving and I hear them, the callers are like, oh yeah, we're going to World Series. We got the best team. I mean, it's amazing what a start does for the fan base. If they had opened 6-8 versus opening what they've opened now, they would be like, oh, it's time to make changes. You got to do this. You got to do that. Tired of cash. And now this thought changes everything. And conversely, we all, and I think rightly so, were worried about the Mets, but give them some credit here. I mean, they went down to Atlanta. And I tell you, you go back. And I was watching that day where they played that brutal doubleheader against the Tigers. They lost the first game. I'm watching now. There's nobody in the building. It's freezing cold. It wasn't a scheduled. It was a scheduled off day. They played a doubleheader because they had been rained out 2 days in a row. They're in the eighth inning. They're getting no hit on their way to 0-6. They're already 0-5. They lost the first game in the doubleheader. Blew a lead. They're 0-6. 0-5 going on 0-6. Getting ready to go on the road, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, at 0-6. And that, what happened in that game, really was important. Because in the eighth inning, Beta got a dump single, a little Texas leaguer, to break the no-hitter. And then in the ninth inning, Alonso comes up, down 1-0, hits a home run into a fierce wind, hits a home run, ties the game up. They win the game in the inning. Go on, win the game 2-1. Go on the road. They go to Cincinnati, win 2 out of 3. They go to Atlanta. They get 2 out of 3 in a rainout. Yesterday, scored 16 runs against the Braves and winning 2 out of 3 against the Braves. So they've won 5 of their last 7. And it started with that ninth inning home run by Alonso. That was, it just shows you how important that was, because it got them a win. It got the manager's first win. It got them off the zero. And they went on the road. And listen, they went to Atlanta, which, you know, is not easy for them. And they came from 4-0 down and won the first game. Almost came back from a huge deficit and won the second game, lost it by 1 run. And then yesterday put up 16 runs in beating the Braves 16-4. I mean, that's a heck of a deal. So they come home a lot happier team right now. At 5-7. Now the Royals come in. And I told you, I was the one team in my over-unders that I almost picked was Kansas City over. And I didn't. And instead, I picked Detroit under. And I'm not worried about Detroit under at 81 because I don't think Detroit's that good. I know they got off to a fast start. They're 7-4. I'm not worried about that. But the Royals are 9-4 and clearly playing a lot more interesting, inspired baseball. So that's one of the real surprises. You know, you got a couple of surprises so far in Major League Baseball. You got some teams that are off to surprising starts. You have the Royals, as I mentioned, okay, at 9-4. Cleveland, who the Yankees see, on 9-3. Didn't expect that out of Cleveland. Cleveland is not Francona's gone. They don't have the same roster. But they're off to a very, very good start. Detroit, 7-4. They opened 6-1. Now they're 7-4. Minnesota, who's supposed to win it, is 4-6. And the White Sox, we know, are terrible. You know that the Pirates are off to a good start at 9-4. Brewers being 8-3 doesn't surprise me. I took them as an over. I thought they were a team that was going to be pretty good this year. I thought that roster was pretty good. I thought they were being underrated. I thought they were a winning team. I really do. The Dodgers are where you expect them to be. Atlanta is 7-4, which you wouldn't worry about. And the Yankees, of course, are 10-3. So, but Kansas City's off to a fast start. And the Pirates are off to a fast start. And conversely, if you're looking for a team, obviously that team that everyone is discussing is the Houston Astros, who are 4-10. Now, you didn't want to write too much into the opening series against the Yankees and say, hey, it's the first four games of the series. You made it. But think about it. That start, the Yankees winning close games, pulling games out, Soto's throw, the defense from Birdie and Verdugo on Sunday when they preserved the victory, the fact that the Alvarez ball went just foul and didn't go out of the park. They started 0-4. Now they're 4-10. 4-10 is a rough start. That's a rough start. That's 14 games. If you play 20-10, the next 30 games, that's a great month if you win 20 games. It would take that to pull them out of the doldrums. If they play 500 for a month, they're going to go into June or late May. Everyone says the Memorial Day is the first time to look. Are they 500 by Memorial Day? Right now, they're 6 games under. What you try to do is pick up a game a week. But that's a bad start. And maybe emblematic of more things being wrong than you think. So the Mets have gotten off the deathbed. It started with that Alonso home run in game 6 against the Tigers. The Yankees are waiting for the judge to arrive to see what that offense looks like when Judge and Soto et al. Are all going together. And, of course, back to the Masters this weekend, which will keep you busy. Now, We'll have coverage all weekend throughout the Masters, so be looking for that. And remember, during each round of the Masters, Bet Rivers is offering betting specials. Visit the Bet Rivers app for full details and discover what awaits each day. So Masters coverage begins 8 o'clock in the morning this morning, and then 3 o'clock this afternoon, and everyone will have caught up and played two rounds. And the theme of day two is, does Scheffler run and hide? Does the number one player who got off with a great six under round, does he run and hide in day two? We'll see you later.
Thanks for listening to the Mike Francesa podcast on the Bet Rivers Network.